There's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way.
This is Rod Adams, and it's time for Atomic Show number 193. And this is a last of the year wrap-up for 2012. With me today, I have four amazing nuclear advocates and nuclear experts of various flavors. Gwyneth Cravens, the author of Power to Save the World, The Truth About Nuclear Energy. Will Davis, the blogger at Atomic Power Review and American Nuclear Society Cafe. Meredith Angwin, who is doing amazing work in Vermont with her blog Yes Vermont Yankee. And Ben Hurd, who is a convert to the nuclear world, who has just released a report called Zero Carbon Options for South Australia. He is a blogger at Decarbonize SA. That's SA for South Australia. And he is coming to us from Australia. Today, we have a very geographically distributed cast of Meredith's in Vermont, Will's in Cleveland, Ohio, Gwyneth is in California, Ben is in South Australia, and I'm here in beautiful, sunny Forest, Virginia. Welcome to all of you.
Thanks, Rod. Nice
to be here. Thank you.
Okay, so we'll go. I'll say again the order that I'd like you all to say something about yourself and let the audience hear your voice. So, Gwyneth, then Ben, then Meredith, then Will.
Well, I'm Gwyneth, and I'm interested in nuclear power in connection with climate change and the environment and public health.
Hi, everyone. I'm Ben Hurd. I'm the director of a consulting company called Think Climate Consulting. I do private work for government and industry in sustainability and climate change. And about 2 years ago, I completed my journey of working through a change of position on nuclear power. Since that time, I've gone on to become a fairly prominent voice in Australia on that subject, which I think says as much about myself as it does about the gap that there was in Australia for that sort of discussion. So it's a real pleasure to be here today and in this company. Thanks for having me.
Hi, I'm Meredith Angwin, and I'm here in Vermont, and most of the time I write about issues in Vermont Yankee, which the state of Vermont has put its money behind trying to shut down Vermont Yankee by, you know, various methods, and Vermont Yankee has fought back since it's fighting the state by lawsuits. In other words, if you want to fight the state, you can't really fight the state anywhere but a court of law, really, when you get right down to it. And I also talk about energy issues in the northeast of the United States, mostly.
Hi, this is Will Davis. I wear a number of hats. I work for the American Nuclear Society as a consultant, and I write for their blog, as Rod mentioned. I also write for my own blog, Atomic Power Review. I also work for Fuel Cycle Week. I write articles for them. And I can finally announce something Meredith knows about, and I've been authorized to finally reveal that I've been elected to the board of directors of Pop Atomic Studios for the 2013-2014 time period in order to push the Nuclear Literacy Project. And some very exciting announcements about that coming up next year. But there'll be a lot more about that in press releases to come.
Very good. And you can hear that we have quite a distinguished crowd today. I asked the invitees to today's conversation to think back a little bit on some of the biggest nuclear news events for 2012 and maybe bring some closure to what was, in many ways, a much better year than 2011. I'm going to start off with what I think was one of the most important developments in nuclear energy in the United States, and that was an effort that was successful in convincing a anti-nuclear activist who had somehow been appointed to a position of extreme responsibility within the nuclear world to take his marbles and go somewhere else. So,
no secret who you're talking about there.
So, anybody who knows
me. He went to Japan, didn't he?
He may have visited Japan. He's probably out spreading his anti-nuclear message in wherever people will listen. But I have no regrets about the fact that Greg Yosko is no longer the chairman of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission here in the United States, and that his single vote against the license for the Vogtle project and the VC Summer project to build four nuclear units here in the U.S. did not change the fact that those units are moving forward. So that's my good news story of the year.
Agree 100%. That made the top of my list as well, Rod.
So, just in terms of the international audience and some of my followers who might get there, I follow this peripherally, but I'd enjoy just a little bit of the background on Greg Yosko and why it is you're so pleased to see the back of him, Rod and Will.
Yeah, I was one who really hoped that the door didn't hit him on the way out, but and I guess it's probably bad form to talk badly about someone who has departed the industry, but in some cases, at least, well, I'm not talking about the departed. He is still very much alive, and I hear there is an opening for an former Nuclear Regulatory Commission representative on the board of directors for the Union of Concerned Scientists. Peter Bradford's getting a little bit long in the tooth, is probably about ready to retire from that position.
Outstanding.
All right, so what else happened this year?
Well, there were a lot of things about Vermont Yankee. The first thing, the really wonderful thing, was that the decision from the federal court came down in favor of Vermont Yankee. The state had sued. The state had attempted to shut down Vermont Yankee and said it had no right to continue to operate. And the federal court saw through a lot of their statements about, well, we're concerned with the reliability of the plant, and noticed that they were using a kind of trade the word way of discussing things. Reliability equals safety. In other words, they kept talking about tritium and how it was going to affect the bones of our children or whatever, and meanwhile talking about reliability. And the court saw through that, and that was quite wonderful. So that was the biggest news here. Meanwhile, the State Public Service Board was faced with a docket that was totally contaminated with all kinds of discussions about safety, and the Public Oversight Committee, which supposedly looked at reliability but only looked at safety. And so they started a new docket. And so that's going on right now. It's sort of one of these never-ending stories around here. Anyway, those two things, the lawsuit and the new docket of the Public Service Board, I think is the big news around here.
Well, I think it was very important for Vermont Yankee to win the court case that said that the federal preemption doctrine held, and that the Atomic Energy Act gives the federal government the full say with regard to safety. I personally think, though, that there were many other aspects that of the case that never really got emphasized well enough. For example, the idea that a initial license period of 40 years means that the plant was only designed to last 40 years is pretty absurd, especially since one of the events of the year that didn't get a whole lot of notice outside of my circles, but the USS Enterprise made its last deployment and was deactivated, not decommissioned yet, but deactivated. The USS Enterprise was patrolling the seas for 51 years with, you know, reactors that were, you know, basically first-generation reactors, and they lasted just fine in an environment that was far more detrimental to the safe operation of mechanical devices.
So, it's far less kindly than commercial reactors.
Yeah, I like to say rode hard and put away wet. When you think about the transients that an aircraft carrier goes through, the going from, you know, all stop to ahead flank, launching aircraft, all kinds of events, and of course being maintained by well-trained, but, you know, mostly a crew of very young high school graduates. I think probably the average age at on a operating crew of an aircraft carrier is somewhere in the neighborhood of 22, 23 years old.
Wow.
So,
I have a question about the Enterprise. Did they have fuel outages? I mean, did they have to replace fuel, or did they run on the same fuel all those years?
Twice, I think. Twice or three times they were refueled.
In 50 years.
Yeah. It's incredible. I mean, it's interesting for me at the moment because one of my clients is the South Australian Freight Council, and I'm having to look at sustainability across different modes of freight, including shipping, obviously. And, you know, it's absolutely disgusting fuel that's used in the international freight industry. And now we're looking at, you know, ideas like slow steaming, basically just chugging along more slowly, or even attaching a sail, you know, to an enormous freighter so that it can get pulled along by the wind out in the open ocean. Meanwhile, these enormous ships have refueled three times in 50 years with no greenhouse emission or other air pollution at all from the propulsion. It just demonstrates how some of these sustainability issues, from a technological point of view at least, are entirely optional. You know, it's just completely unnecessary.
And no risk to the health of the crew of the Enterprise from the propulsion, you know, from the power.
Oh, I dare say distinctly less risk. The emissions, not the greenhouse emissions, but, you know, when you're using residual fuel oil, which is horribly low-grade fuel, the sulfur pollutants are extraordinarily high. It would have been incredibly less risk to the crew. Really just amazing technology. It should be used more broadly.
Yeah, Ben, I read one time recently that the commercial shipping, which only burns about 6% of the world's oil, was responsible for 50% of the sulfur pollution from petroleum.
That's about right.
Yeah, that very low-grade fuel. I believe in the U.S.
Bunker tea oil.
That's the stuff. And the standards are in the thousands of times more sulfur emissions permitted out in ocean from that type of fuel than you would permit from a land-based vehicle. They are being changed and upgraded, but they're being upgraded to the point where that residual fuel oil basically needs to be eliminated from supply and just won't be able to be used anymore. It's been a horribly polluting industry for a very long time.
Right, and what's going to happen to the shipping industry is that the fuel price will double or triple compared to burning residual fuel oil, which is why, you know, very expensive ships are talking about reducing their speed, which for a transportation asset, that means that the total number of trips that the ship can make every year drops by whatever percent they reduce their speed.
That's right. And that's going to be the transition pathway, along with talk of using LNG as the fuel or higher grade diesel. But you're right, it's going to go into direct competition with other uses of higher grade diesel. Meanwhile, sitting on the sidelines, we're retiring a 51-year-old aircraft carrier that's used nuclear technology with no pollution for 50 years. You've got to ask questions about the way we think about these types of sustainability issues.
Well, I of course don't ask questions anymore. I've come to the conclusion. You know, I'm pretty certain that the reason that we don't use more nuclear energy at sea and in other places is that the world's fossil fuel industry simply works very hard to maintain their market share and has used all kinds of techniques, including capturing people within the environmental community as their agents. You know, I'm not talking about conspiracy. I'm talking about straight business activity. It's not surprising for any business to do whatever they can to spread fear, uncertainty, and doubt about a competitor, particularly when they have no other way to legitimately compete with that competitor.
Absolutely. It's not a conspiracy. You could run up and down Main Street shouting at the top of your lungs that the fossil fuel industry is trying to put competitors out of business, and no one's going to blink an eyelid. Everyone already knows that.
And nuclear power is really the only serious threat to the fossil fuel industry. They love wind power because it means more fossil fuels will be burned to back up the wind, and same with solar.
Well, fortunately, you know, I've mentioned to many of you at times that part of my strategy in a long-term sense is to divide and conquer. And there has been some interesting developments in the last year or so where people who are selling fossil fuels have recognized that the wind is not always their friend, because in some places there's been so much wind development that wind forces other generators in the system to shut down to allow the wind to continue supplying power, which means that there's an awful lot of capital assets that are no longer generating revenue at times when they expected to generate revenue. It's also a concern for the natural gas industry itself, because natural gas is one of those fuels that is best provided on a rather steady basis. It's not easy to throttle back the production from wells or fracked areas or whatever in order to respond to the fact that we've had a couple of windy days in a row. And that really does happen because the gas industry doesn't have a whole lot of storage. There's not a whole lot of buffer in the system. They pretty much like to drag the gas out of the ground and deliver it directly to a customer who's going to burn it and keep that flow moving.
Yeah, we've got more or less exactly that situation in South Australia. I think, as we mentioned in our previous discussion, Rod, you know, we're having overnight periods where no one else can sell any power, when that was, you know, a standard period of time to sell power at an okay price overnight. And that part of the market's just being sucked away because the wind performs very well overnight at the lower period of demand, which, you know, it's unhelpful. And I mean, I'll say on the other side of that argument that South Australia has among the lowest greenhouse gas emissions in Australia because of the wind development, and it has been achieved quite quickly. So from a greenhouse point of view, there is a good news story there, to a point. But then from a network management perspective, you start to run into troubles at about where we are now, which is 25-odd% of the energy coming from the wind. And then it just starts to get harder and harder, and every new bit of wind to incorporate is harder, and it makes the rest of the system harder to manage. So, you know, I think that if we wanted to take action quickly in, you know, a lot of parts of the world, Australia included, wind is useful in that it can be done quite fast. You know, we've done it quite quickly here, and there's been a positive result from it. But it's really wrong-headed for advocates to think that just because we've achieved 25%, we can go on to achieve 50 or 75 or 100. That's just completely and utterly incorrect.
Well, one of the lessons from history that seems to be ignored is just how rapidly you can deploy nuclear power to move from almost zero to, here in the U.S., 20%, and in France, 80% of a much larger market than South Australia.
Oh, absolutely. Yep, that is absolutely correct. But from the point of view of where we sit in Australia with this debate, you know, it's going to take us some time. So I'd have a point of view where I'd like to see not South Australia, but some of the other more populous states of Australia perhaps increase their wind penetration to some levels that aren't really going to trouble the networks, but are going to have a positive greenhouse impact. But not just keep on pressing the South Australian penetration into areas that just become troublesome. But meanwhile, we've got to be getting that nuclear debate underway and then start building multiple plants at a time so we can get that sort of a massive decline in greenhouse emissions that we actually need.
Now, Ben, you mentioned one of the interesting news stories that you saw was when the German Energy Agency head admitted that the expansion of wind and solar in Germany is providing some practical problems that aren't covered in the press releases that talk about solar providing 50% of the electricity in Germany for one sunny afternoon on a Saturday in May.
Absolutely. It's an interview with Stephen Kohler on 15th of November with Der Spiegel. And his frankness is incredibly refreshing, and I think is suggestive of the fact that his, I presume, is not an elected position, but he simply is tasked with making the whole thing hang together. And the barriers that he are highlighting is incredibly clear and incredibly straightforward, and he's just upfront in saying the reality is, this is a quote, the reality is that we'll need conventional power plants until at least 2050, even if we do create massive renewable energy sources. Many people dispute this. They say we could replace power plants operated with fossil fuels by adding more renewable energy sources. My response to them is it won't work. Now, he's the guy who knows. You know, he's the guy who has to actually run the system, and he goes on to outline in pretty clear detail just what these barriers are, and they are really, really huge and significant, particularly that a country like Germany is thinking of solar. I mean, you know, the report that I've just released has highlighted that solar finds it difficult to compete in South Australia, and we have one of the best raw solar resources in the whole world. To imagine that a country like Germany would be presuming to do well on their energy supply out of solar is just nuts, just nuts in my opinion. So, yeah, Stephen Kohler made some really great remarks, and I found it very refreshing.
You mean latitude and clouds and those kinds of things are something one should consider when trying to decide whether to use solar or not?
Yeah, it's a funny business, that, isn't it, Rod? The thing with solar is it does need sun, and, you know, preferably regular and reliable sun. And, you know, in some parts of the world, the best parts of the world, like California or Spain or South Australia, you look at what it can deliver and you do your analysis and see whether or not you want to build it. And if it's going to be difficult there, yeah, you know what, probably Germany, not that crash hot, I wouldn't have thought.
Well, there's a reason Germany is building more coal-fired plants and lignite-fired plants.
Exactly.
No, in Vermont, there's the same push for solar, and I mean, sometimes I say, but we have more sun than Germany does, because I guess we have somewhat less cloudy days, though we're further north than most of. Anyway, it's quite ridiculous, actually. That's a problem, and that is that I say that renewables can do it. The Shumlin plan is that renewables will be 90% of all Vermont's energy use in 40 years. And I was quoted in the paper as saying that that was impossible in 40 years and might be impossible forever. And I got quite a lot of people very upset about that. As I would say to George as we open the paper in the morning, have I got any hate mail today?
Well, Meredith, didn't a bunch of people get very angry out there when they started to mow down the mountaintops and put up wind turbines for destroying their scenery?
As a matter of fact, that is very much the case. And the Vermont Senate has 30 people in it, the state Senate. And according to a news release I saw today, the president pro tem of the Senate said 18 of them are planning to vote for a wind moratorium for 3 years because people have gotten very upset about the high-handedness of it. You see, one of the things is that a town will vote against the wind going into the town. They'll say, okay, you want to put wind up, don't do it on our ridges. And then the Public Service Board in Shumlin will pressure and they'll put up some test towers, and people are getting really upset. They feel they're losing control of their own towns. Especially,
which they are.
You understand that the people have been fighting against, you know, housing developments with beautiful views up there and all this. They've been saying, no, Vermont is supposed to look a certain way. It's supposed to have wooded hills. And so now you're telling us we're bad people because we want to conserve the wooded hills of Vermont and wooded, you know. So it's there's a rebellion going on in Vermont. There's a wind moratorium rebellion going on.
Well, the good thing
they're finding out that it's heavy industry. A wind farm is heavy industry with a lot of concrete and a lot of steel and a lot of roads and a lot of disfigurement of the natural setting.
Especially when
more concrete and steel per megawatt hour than nuclear.
Yeah.
By far.
And it's important when you see a tower making its way up to the hill through the small towns and trying to turn the corners on, you know, I've got some pictures in my library of what that really looks like, because wind towers are pretty darn large, especially when you're trying to build a wind turbine that's maybe 3 or 4 megawatts. It requires a tower that's about 400 feet tall, and in order to make that stable with a very large, you know, power generator and wind blades on it, you have to have a pretty large base. It's just about as big as you can possibly get in diameter and still travel on a road with wide load type escorts. So it's a pretty impactful technology. But the good news for you, Meredith,
can I make
is
one little,
go ahead.
A comment about that Shumlin was always saying Vermont Yankee was run by Entergy Louisiana, and they don't do things the same way in Louisiana or something. And recently he's come out against wind activists as being cavers, people who, I don't remember what it stands, citizens against anything or something. It was just, and I'm like, wow, he just comes up with these names, doesn't he? Cavers.
That's probably citizens against virtually everything.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing is that, and what I was going to say is that you probably don't need to worry too much about a moratorium, because the wind industry in the United States, unless a last-minute amendment gets thrown in as a result of the fiscal cliff, will essentially stop dead in its tracks on the 31st of December, because we are no longer going to be providing $22 a megawatt hour for a direct subsidy from taxpayers to wind developers. And, you know, I've been reading a lot of renewable energy news, and you know, they're pretty certain that the industry will lay off about 32,000 employees because they don't have a single project in the queue, which, you know, it sounds like a bad thing, but if you do the analysis, you can figure out that each one of those employees would cost taxpayers somewhere on the order of $400,000 for a year's worth of employment.
It's interesting. In the analysis that we did, we looked at workforce benefits for energy. But really, you know, I find that's a bit of an imaginary criteria. Energy projects aren't in and of themselves supposed to be a job creation exercise. And if the job creation is super enormously high, that's probably another way of saying that it's really, really, really expensive. You know, energy is supposed to power an economy to let other people do the economic activity for the job creation. And we actually want to provide the energy at a good price and not have construction costs that are overly high. If there's not massive amounts of jobs in something, that doesn't necessarily mean it's a bad deal. That could mean it's a fantastic deal because the energy is a decent value product.
Yeah, I like to tell people, I think it was a guy who used to publish a newsletter called Access to Energy. He once said, if you really want, if you want to focus on jobs, let's just get rid of trucks and start carrying things on our back again. There'd be plenty of work to move things from place to place. One example. But energy is an enabler. And one of the things that has always fascinated me about nuclear energy is that it is an enabler with the lowest input of materials compared to any other energy alternative. As Will said, if you want to look at the capital per megawatt hour for a wind turbine or a solar installation versus nuclear, it's somewhere around four times as much concrete and steel and copper and all of those other things because of the fact that the wind and the solar installations are going to be very large to collect the diffuse energy, and they're going to be sitting idle about 70 to 80% of the time. That capital, that those materials that you put into those are simply going to be sitting around waiting for the wind to blow or the sun to shine.
Yeah, I noticed you picked up on some of my tweets about the Xingu River in Brazil. I was watching a documentary about that just a couple of nights ago. And here we have a country that's developing very fast, does need energy, and we have a proposal to put a mega dam on a huge river that's going to flood 108 square kilometers of river and forest, change the hydrology of a river, and possibly be a wedge for a whole lot more hydro damming in that region. When to get the equivalent amount of energy, more reliably, I might say, because Brazil goes through wet and dry seasons, so the hydro dam won't perform consistently over time, you'd need about four large nuclear power plants that you could build on a very small land footprint close to where the demand even is, not requiring corridors of transmission, corridors of electricity to get it. If we want conservation outcomes as well, when we're putting the planet under so much pressure, the energy density of nuclear brings huge advantages, and it's incredibly devastating, I think, that environmentalists refuse to concede that by saying no to nuclear, they are not automatically getting a win in the energy sources of their choice. There will be others that come through with worse impacts that they're not prepared to acknowledge, and I think that's changing. I think we've seen some change in that in 2012. I hope it keeps going. I don't know what anyone else thinks, whether that trend is going well.
Well, we do have two converts on this show.
True.
Will and Meredith, Meredith, you were a renewables person before.
Yeah, when I started out in energy, actually, I wanted to work in renewables, specifically geothermal, and I was working in it, but my first job wasn't in geothermal. It was at Accurex, where I was working on nitrogen oxide from combustion, trying to prevent nitrogen oxides from forming in gas turbines. But I wanted to work in renewables. And so I got a job at EPRI as a project manager in the renewables group in geothermal. And I was there for a couple of years and then decided it wasn't really getting anywhere. I began to see the problems of trying to, there's not that much high temperature geothermal around, and people fight it all the time. And anyway, and I didn't want to go back to combustion because I had a pretty good idea that some of those problems were just not solvable. And anyway, so I went into nuclear. So I was a convert, but I converted way back in the 80s, you see. So at this point, I can say to people, I've been in the nuclear industry for umpteen years, 20 years or 25 years, whatever. But I couldn't even say I've been in it as long as Gunderson, but I don't say that. And Anyway, sorry, that was a mean crack. But I was so amazed, you know, when I was in a debate with him, and he said he'd been in the nuclear industry for 40 years, and when I add up all the time I've been in it, it doesn't come to 40 years because I didn't, you know, like start it until in the 80s. And before that, I was in geothermal and combustion.
Yeah, but Gunderson counts testifying against nuclear energy as being in the nuclear industry.
That's very important to understand, yeah.
Gunderson was fired from his job in the nuclear industry in 1990. So as far as I'm concerned, he gets to count about 19 years based on his resume. He also at one point claimed that he started working as a nuclear engineer in 1970, but he didn't actually graduate from college until 1971. So anyway. That's just...
He's just rounding. He's just rounding, Ron.
It's rounding. I'm sorry. Yeah, I have this particular notion about facts.
Well, about numerical accuracy.
Numerical accuracy tends to be important in the nuclear business.
Yes. Well, we'll just give him credit for a little embellishment and not inaccuracy. How about that?
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm one who believes that resumes really do count and that it's not really as important what is exactly on the resume, but it really is important how honest a person is about what their resume says.
Correct.
Because integrity does matter to me. And Will, you can't really claim to be a convert because you've been in this thing since you were about 17 or 18 years old, right?
Yeah, I'm not a convert. I was made a believer from the start. And that's why I advocated today, because just like you, I've seen what it can do.
It's pretty amazing when you really have had the opportunity to, as I tell people, I was at one point on the first name basis with a nuclear reactor. I even hugged the darn thing and thanked it for getting me back and forth.
I have stood on one and sworn at it.
Well, then you're really a friend if you can swear at it, and it will forgive you for that. Yeah, that's good.
It did. It, things went the way I wanted, and everything went fine.
All right. So, Will, you had a couple more things that you wanted to bring up tonight as kind of highlights of 2012.
But, well, you already mentioned one, which is the maybe the watershed event, and that was Vogtle getting its COL in February to kind of end the drought of commercial reactor construction in the United States.
Yeah, that is a situation that is important to know that we're moving forward. It's also important for people who are interested in the nuclear industry and nuclear progress to understand what it means to build the first of a kind of anything,
and yes, to not absolutely correct
to not get too depressed when you hear people who are adamantly opposed point out that you know the schedules are changing or that there's additional costs or that there's some conflicts among the contractors. It's a big, complex project, and it's the first reactor that we've built in the United States in a very long time. It's, you know, you have to form teams, and you have to come together and figure things out. And the other thing that we're doing there is that we're using a licensing path that has never actually been done before. There's a reason why Congress needed to pass the Energy Policy Act of 2005 and provide some incentives to be the first one out of the block. As anybody who's been in any nuclear industry gathering, you know that most leaders in nuclear companies said, you know, I'd love to be the second guy to build X, or I'd love to buy the third of a kind, because everybody knows that being first is hard.
Absolutely. But I was just going to say that there's a completely different, you know, attitude between energy sources about what the expectations are, you know, in terms of whether, you know, something is an acceptable challenge or an unacceptable outcome seems to depend on whether you agree with or disagree with nuclear power. In Australia, we seem prepared to accept an enormous amount of money and support for certain energy technologies in the name of decarbonizing a country that has incredibly cheap fossil fuels. But still, same voices seem to suggest that nuclear either must be 100% commercially competitive in this country or it doesn't have a role, which is not really going to get us anywhere.
It's an interesting point. One of the things that I do that's a little bit different than some is I thoroughly believe that cheap energy is a wonderful boon for human beings, and I have no problem with natural gas being sold at an artificially low price and giving some real economic benefit to Americans. I just think that there should be more people who are doing what the people at SCANA are doing, which is taking advantage of having low energy prices, low inflation, and low cost of capital to build high-quality, long-lived assets like nuclear power plants. I've listened quite a few times to the, I can't remember his name right now, but the CEO of SCANA, which is a company building VC Summer. And VC Summer didn't ask for a loan guarantee. They have said they're not really even interested in getting any government help because they're able to project out that they're going to come in under budget because their cost of capital is so much lower than what they expected, and the cheap natural gas is keeping inflation low, which is keeping the cost of labor low, and it's keeping the cost of materials lower than they expected. So there are some advantages of doing big capital projects at a time when energy costs are low.
Mm-hmm. It's makes sense.
Different, I mean, it's completely different than the things that drove the cost overruns in the 1970s when people were paying 17, 18, 20% interest on borrowed money, and fuel bills were getting outrageously expensive in the late 1970s when the Arab and oil embargo had happened in the early 70s, and then the Iranian crisis happened in 79, and the real price of oil in 1980 was $40 a barrel. In 1980, dollars, it was pretty expensive stuff.
Absolutely.
But I'm excited by the fact that we're building nuclear plants. We're training operators. I've been reading about the wonderful training facility that has been built down at Vogtle. I'm actually thinking about going down to a conference that's taking place in Augusta in April, I believe, a Women in Nuclear conference, which is one of my it's one of my favorite organizations to go visit with.
Well, something we're excited about that's coming out of the U.S. That someone else mentioned as a topic is the small modular reactors, because that's a development which, A, could be really exciting, I think, for you guys in terms of the product you can sell, but, B, it potentially provides a product that can overcome a lot of those financing hurdles that would be faced in a country like Australia to get started with a nuclear power program, and the timing might be incredibly fortuitous. So, you know, the development and support for reactors at about 180 or 200 megawatts per generating unit, that's something that observers in Australia are particularly keen to keep a close eye on, and we've got a lot of hope for that.
And I did not pay Ben to say that.
No. Yeah.
But can she want
a disclaimer? You can tack in a disclaimer at the end of the broadcast.
Yeah, I have to admit that I was holding back in sharing the delight that we felt in Lynchburg, Virginia, about a month or so ago when the Department of Energy announced that they had made a selection on who was going to be the first, hopefully of many, but the first partner in a small modular reactor development with the Department of Energy. And it is the company that I work for, so... full disclosure, I'm an employee of B&W Empower. We're really excited about small modular reactors. We've been working on this project with our own money since 2008, 2009. So it's pretty exciting stuff. And our each of our modules will be right in the range that, Ben mentioned, 180 megawatts will be what we're targeting to supply. But we expect it will probably most customers should buy two of them at a time, because they're really nice to have, that units that will be able to supply reliable, emission-free power at a low marginal cost.
I got to say, Rob, I think there's something supremely fitting about the fact that you guys are going in at Clinch River.
And what's so fitting about that?
Because that's where the Clinch River Breeder Reactor project was partly constructed and then stopped. And a lot of people, myself included, wonder if that wasn't kind of the last lingering end of perhaps the first nuclear era.
Well, it's quite possible. The Clinch River Breeder Reactor, I guess, was completely shut down by about, 1985, 86?
Yeah, it was shut down in 83 or 4, I think. They finally killed the last lingering funding.
But I agree with where you're going, Will. I think, you know, small modular reactors could absolutely signal a new era in nuclear. And, disclosure again, you know, Rod didn't pay me, but, you know, door's always open, Rod, so, you know, I'll send you some details. But, you know, seriously, we look at that and we see the potential of it in the market that we have and the sort of grid that we have and the sort of small population density over a large area, the advantages that it brings in terms of just the vision of it with the underground installation, the potential for it to arrive partly or completely constructed. These would all be serious advantages in nations that are yet to embrace nuclear power, making a start and getting over the line. You know, the cost control advantages, it's numerous, and there's going to be a lot more focus on that at a conference in Australia in the middle of the year, I'm pleased to say. So I think it is a very significant development, very, very positive.
I think you might have some competition here the first quarter of this next year, though, Rod.
Now, like I said, I really want this to be a come on in, the water's fine environment, because, you know, I look around at some people view competition as knocking out the competitors. I really believe that businesses, industries develop far better with competition, with clusters of people who are all thinking similar thoughts but different, similar past, but maybe something that one guy thinks about nobody else did until he actually does it. I mean, look at what's happened in the environment of handheld computers, and I'm amazed. I did an inventory of my own home during the holidays, and I counted up that my poor network was supporting 22 devices that were talking to it. When I had 14 guests in a house. Now, that meant that I had an average of more than one device per person.
Yeah.
But, you know, iPads, iPods, PowerBooks, there was even a non-Apple laptop. It was pretty amazing. But, I think about...
Such things do exist.
And when I graduated from college, you know, I'm not that old a guy, but I guess I'm not so young anymore, but I graduated from college in 1981, which is the year that the IBM personal computer was released to the market. It's just fascinating to me.
It's mind-blowing.
Yeah, when you get people thinking, and there's so many things that can be done with the fission process, and I just finished reading a very interesting book that was just released last month called Carbon Crunch by a guy named Dieter Helm from the UK. And he's an Oxford professor who really is interested in doing something effective about climate change, but completely disses nuclear energy as having no real potential for growth. And even he calls himself a technological optimist, in part of the book, but he he says, well, you know, nuclear hasn't really changed much since the 1950s. They're still using the same stuff as they did then. And the illogic of the idea that, you know, 10 years after we first discovered fission, we figured out the best way to use it. That doesn't make sense.
Yeah. How could that be possible?
You know, it's sort of like the guy from the patent office who thought that there was no reason to keep the patent office open because everything that had been invented had obviously had been developed already. It just doesn't make sense.
Absolutely.
You know, this fission stuff is fascinating. We've got I had a pretty good year. We got some things that got started. We got a lot of work to do.
Something we were pleased to see globally was the serious change in direction, or perhaps revert, for Japan, just back to a position of common sense with regards to their nuclear power. And that was really welcome from my point of view, because I'd been involved in some article rebuttals of suggestions that, you know, that this was a wonderful romantic thing that was happening, that Japan had turned off their nuclear power plants and that this was going to be the dawn of a new renewable age, which is obviously completely ridiculous. If you look at a country that's got 200 odd million people in an archipelago that's about 70% mountain, that's just not going to be a renewables paradise. It's not going to happen. And sure enough, it wasn't happening. You know, it was fossil fuel burning was increasing. And that's a country that had very high greenhouse gas emissions. But for 20 years, greenhouse gas emissions from their electricity sector had not budged, hadn't changed at all in 20 years. And for the first time, they spiked. So to see the change in policy direction there is really welcome. It was an immediate uptick in the uranium price, which is a little more interesting if you're an Australian because we export so much of it. Not that I have any direct interest in uranium mining, but I did notice that. Just to see that those sorts of flights of fancy really do get checked by reality pretty fast, and lets people because that's one of the most pernicious myths going around in Australia is the unnecessary nature of nuclear, that it's not required, that it's not needed, to which people like myself and Barry Brook, who most of you will know as well, frequently say, you know, if there is any single country in the world that possibly could decarbonize without nuclear, it might be Australia, with only 22 million people occupying a whole continent with massive amounts of sunshine and wind and coastline and raw geothermal resource. But it won't be fast and it won't be cheap. And we're actually in a little bit of a hurry here. So to think that, you know, it's that difficult for a country like Australia, and then for anyone to presume that Japan would just switch off nuclear power and replace 30% of its electricity with renewable sources, that's ludicrous. So it's refreshing, I guess, to see that reality has stepped in. They're going to stop spending that huge amount of money that they've been wasting on fossil fuels for nearly 2 years that could have gone into their reconstruction efforts, for example, after a catastrophe. To imagine that they wasted all of that money on fossil fuels, billions of dollars, is terrible. And that should see a nice return to reality, I think, in the next year or two, about the position of nuclear power and its role globally.
Yeah, one of the things, though, that people should remember if they're looking at the world and seeing the illogic of shutting down 50 operable reactors and spending $55 billion extra a year in fossil fuels is that somebody somewhere around the world sold an extra $55 billion worth of fossil fuels to a country that really didn't really need them, but because and there's some interesting coverage about that topic in Dieter Helm's book, because he mentions the fact that there are many places around the world where security of demand is just as important as security of supply, and that they really want to make sure there's a place where their production's going to go. And when you start putting those thoughts together, you start to realize just how tempting it must be for people who are interested in selling more and more fossil fuels to do whatever they can to cause people to be fearful of nuclear energy.
Oh, Rod, they would have been delighted. I mean, it's the fifth largest economy in the world that was getting about 30% of its electricity from nuclear power all of a sudden shut off. I mean, that is a dream. If you're selling, you know, the next most portable energy-dense fuel, even though it's, you know, millions of times less energy-dense than a pellet of uranium, that's awesome news. There's no doubt about that. That's exactly what you want. And I think Gwyneth said earlier, nuclear is the only serious competitor to fossil fuels out there. There's no question about that. And, you know, I think environmentalists need to think, you know what, from my point of view, they could go on hating nuclear if they like. They could go on trying to shut it down. But, you know, it'd be like facing off against a slavering, furious Rottweiler versus a slightly irritated Chihuahua in terms of the, you know, environmental impacts of the two industries. They are just incomparably different. And we could have a world that's 99.95% better. And, you know, spend 100 years maybe fixing up that last 0.5%, or, hey, what the hell, maybe we could move on to some other sustainability problems that are actually a little more difficult.
Well, I
would like to see a study done in Japan of whether during the 2 years of this excessive fossil fuel combustion, what the health impacts of that have been and or will be.
Well, I'll just attribute it to Fukushima Daiichi if it's bad.
Well, I'm just talking about the burning of fossil fuels.
I'm just being funny facetious.
Pardon?
but
you're right, Gwyneth. You're absolutely right.
I just was reviewing some statements by the World Health Organization about their conclusions about the exposure from people living right around Fukushima, and the outcome is negligible. That's the bottom line. Mm-hmm. If prior to Fukushima there was a 0.037% chance of someone getting thyroid cancer, that's gone up to possibly 10% greater risk. And they're using thyroid cancer findings from Chernobyl, which I don't understand, because Chernobyl is a place where there's a problem with iodine deficiency in the diet in the Chernobyl area. It's just low in iodine naturally. And the Japanese consume iodine all day long in seaweed and fish. So they really have even got more protection from thyroid cancer, which might be the most common cancer that would pop up after a release from a nuclear plant. Mm-hmm. But the health impact turns out to be they keep the children indoors in the region and playing video games and stuff, and they're feeding them processed food. So they're getting fat and pale, and probably will have health problems as a result of not leading the healthy traditional Japanese life that involves eating a lot of fresh fruits and vegetables and being outside doing stuff.
I wonder, Gwyneth, whether you saw an article that was about a restaurant open in Tokyo specifically dedicated to supplying food from the Fukushima region. It was an amazing good news story. This guy opened...
Oh, no, I didn't know about that.
Yeah, this is brilliant. This guy opened this restaurant specifically to say, hey, look, we're open for business. The food's great and it's fresh and it's healthy. And people are going and people are supporting it and people are saying, yeah, you know what? It's probably time to stop stigmatizing our fellow Japanese here. Let's eat this food. Let's enjoy it. Oh, yeah, I'll send you the link. It's brilliant. Brilliant news.
I would love it. That's fantastic.
I'll make sure I send it on. And it just, you know, a little bit of familiarity and all of a sudden that fear can go away quick smart. And there's some lovely quotes from the customers in there saying, you know what, we come back because this food's delicious. It's really, really good. So, yeah, I'll pass that on to you. But,
you're
right. Those contrary health impacts. Again, going to the work I'm doing at the moment in freight, air pollution in Adelaide is responsible for about a few thousand premature deaths every year, we believe. And Adelaide's got really clean air. You know, we don't have a lot of heavy industry, and cars are reasonably modern and standards are pretty good, et cetera, et cetera. But we're still copping a few thousand premature deaths every year. Now, if you replace 30% of your electricity with something that produces soot and particulates and nitric oxides and sulfur, you're going to have health impacts over a two-year period. There's no question about that.
Well, they've done a lot of studies in the United States about that, and around the most recent statistics I know about, there are 20,000 deaths a year from fossil fuel combustion to produce electricity annually. Mm. Probably many more if you include automobile exhausts and stuff like that. Mm. But which is, of course, fossil fuel combustion as well. And I wanted to also make a comment while we're on this topic about trucks, and we should just carry things on our backs. In France, they figured out another thing. Instead of carrying things on your back, instead of having trucks, having high-speed electric railroads powered by nuclear plants. And it's worked out really well for France.
Absolutely. Where you've got the density.
A big reduction in lung disease in France and so on as a result of the nuclear powered transportation system.
Yeah, and when we were in France, I believe they were also adding trolleys and those kinds of things back to some of the small towns where, you know, trolleys can be powered with overhead electric lines. That's really, really modern technology dating back to about 1900. But
They pulled the trolleys out in here where I live. They pulled trolleys out where I live here in 1930 or so. And now a lot of people like to go back.
Well, the electric car, especially if you. I mean, there's no point in having an electric car if you're using a coal-fired plant to charge it, but if you have clean nuclear electricity to charge that car, God bless.
Yeah, you bet. And that's something, again, that Rod and I discussed just the other day, which is suggestions that we need to go on a conservation binge may have merit, but people who are interested in full decarbonization, we've got to decarbonize our liquid fuels as well. We've got to get off our transport fuels. We've got to get off the fuels that we use for space heating, and that's all going to mean electricity. So, more electricity is going to be needed. It needs to be clean. That's just a reality that we've got to work with. And when I do my lecturing at Adelaide Uni, a lot of it I'm trying to get people to embrace a sort of a mindset that says we have to achieve sustainability within some bounds of the reality of what we're going to be facing between now and 2050. And once you've drawn those boundaries and just understood a few key truths, the task actually becomes a heck of a lot easier, because you don't keep going over old ground and trying to argue the impossible, trying to say, well, we need to cut population. You know what? The things that we need to do that are largely being done. They're being done really successfully. The two-child family is now the norm in most of the world, and the rate of population growth has been slowing since about 1980. It just takes a long time to top out, but it's topping out. That process is underway. The same with energy. Once you can embrace the fact that we are going to need it if we're going to get where we're going, then it makes the decision-making process a heck of a lot easier.
And as it turns out...
Excuse me.
No problem. As it turns out, the countries that have the most electricity and the most reliable electricity tend to have right at sustainable population development, because we've got plenty of other things to do with our time.
That's it. The more prosperous a country is, the more likely that women have more control over their bodies and their reproductive systems and so on.
Absolutely, and the opportunity cost of every child becomes higher, because women have something else that they can be doing with their time, as you say. And something Hans Rosling said, which was beautiful, about pre-state societies and tribes who do end up having an average of about two children each, he said, people think that they're living in harmony with nature. He said, they're not. They're dying in harmony with nature because they're having about six births to end up with two children. And they're living through four tragedies. These are just some things that people, you know, need to understand when they think about that population issue.
Yeah. And it's extremely important to bring up the standard of living so that, and to introduce things like birth control and so on, and having energy, cheap, abundant, clean energy is a real big boost in that direction. And I want to add one other thing about just about the small modular reactors. When I'm talking to women's groups and so on, they especially like small modular reactors because they're afraid of those great big cooling towers that are kind of ominous, and the big nuclear plants are, you know, scary, and what if they blow up and everything. But if you talk about small underground modular reactors, they get all, you know, people relax a little and find those more acceptable. And a lot of people like the idea of replacing the Tennessee Valley Authority, the idea of replacing these coal-fired plants, these old coal-fired plants, with small modular reactors. And I understand that Dr. Wilcox is right up to speed on that.
All right, who's banging around?
You what?
Somebody's banging around while Gwyneth is talking.
Nope. Not here. I'm just thinking that you've got another paid caller.
No, that's got to be my kids that have arrived home. So I'll go to mute when I'm not talking.
Okay, great.
Starting now.
I do want to mention something while we're not too far away from the topic of Japan, because there's some good discussion about what's going on in Japan, and hopefully they've turned the corner. Something that's gone practically completely unreported in any of the news. The money losses by TEPCO have been reported, and certainly their latest request to the Japanese government for another loan were reported. But has anybody seen what Tokyo Electric Power is doing at the Kashiwazaki Kariwa nuclear plant?
No.
They have got a massive work project underway there. The most massive seawall I have ever seen, and major reinforcements to the plant and additions to the plant to make it earthquake and tsunami proof. They're spending a lot of money and time at that plant, and it's getting no press. But it's pretty clear that Tokyo Electric Power is putting their money in that as being the plant they're going to start back up.
Wow.
And if you want to see video of that for proof, Tokyo Electric released it. It just didn't get any airplay on NHK or any Japanese press. But if you go to my YouTube channel from Atomic Power Review, it's actually in the favorites list, the modifications. They give you a little tour of Kashiwazaki Kariwa. And for those who don't know, that's the largest nuclear plant in the world.
It's got, what, 7 units?
7 units, yeah.
Yeah, some of the most modern ABWRs ever built are there at KK. They hadn't even quite got back to full power at the time of the tsunami, right? There was still one or two of those units that were shut down as a result of an earthquake in 2008, if I'm not mistaken.
I believe you are correct, yes.
Well, that's good news. Of course, I was really excited by the voters in Japan, and the way they surprised so many of the pundits when they turned to the only party available that was not trying to say we're never going to use nuclear again, and voted them.
Yeah, they voted with common sense. They're tired of being in rolling brownouts and without exports and. They've got two up now. They restarted two reactors in OE number 3 and 4 in July. Mm-hmm. And let's hope that Kashiwazaki Kariwa is next. Although the latest statements from their new nuclear regulatory authorities seem to indicate that they can't complete their regulatory reviews anytime soon.
Well, I think I'm going to end with one last thought about that is that the Japanese have been told that they can do without nuclear. I believe that, like many other people around the world, they're trying to ask themselves, why would they want to? You know, really, what happened that would cause them to make so many sacrifices to avoid such a small risk? You know, as I mentioned in my email to you all, I think that the big news for me, and to try to keep sharing with the world, is that the sky did not fall. The people who claimed that it was going to fall have been proven wrong with what we used to call in the Navy an inadvertent theory to practice evolution.
That's when the plant runs drills on you instead of you running drills with the plant.
That shows that you really can, and not that we would ever want to. We really want to avoid this at all costs. Well, not at all costs. We really want to avoid this. We really can melt three reactor cores and not hurt anybody.
Yeah. And talking about the sky didn't fall. We had Hurricane Sandy here that was predicted, you know, in the short term to be doom and gloom. And you, Rod, said before the hurricane, and so did I, so did some other people, that nothing was going to happen. And lo and behold, nothing did.
No, they tried to gin up some stuff happening, but it didn't happen.
It still didn't happen.
Yeah.
You can paint it any color you want. It still didn't happen.
Yeah.
Yeah, but there's no accountability, is there? You know, when these statements are made, you know, I tread so carefully with the statements that I make, what I put in writing, what I commit to, because I've got a degree of respect for the people that I'm speaking with. And if I'm proven to be incorrect in something that I said, I'll make a prompt correction. And that's probably happened once or twice in the couple of years that I've been at it. That seems to be an incredibly one-sided situation. To give you an example, from 8th of May in Australia, an article, The End of Nuclear, by Matthew Wright, that I wrote a rebuttal to, starts off, it happened at 5 p.m. on Saturday, the 5th of May. Tamari Reactor Number 3 ceased production. This means Japan is now nuclear-free for the first time since 1966. And goes on to claim and to talk about how this is going to continue and what Japan's going to do, et cetera, et cetera. Well, that is now completely and utterly clear that that's incorrect, but there will be no reckoning for that type of a statement. And people on that side of the debate seem to have a completely free run in the public eye to make those sorts of statements. And I'm not quite sure why. Are they seen as acting more in people's interests than a nuclear advocate, and therefore they get more give in what they say? I'm just not sure, but there is no reckoning process for those types of statements. And the things that come out of Fukushima, and particularly out of Sandy, which you mentioned as well, just incredibly, incredibly fear-mongering things being said which didn't come true at all. And then they can just walk away from those statements. I'm not quite sure how that functions. What do you guys think?
Well, ask Amory Lovins, because he's the expert in predicting the end of nuclear power. And the replacement of nuclear power with solar and wind.
Yeah. he's pretty good at it by now.
He's absolutely unfazed by, anything you can say or, you know, any contradiction you can offer. And he just goes about it.
I don't get that. I mean, I feel really abashed when I get something wrong. I'm really troubled by it.
Well, Rod Adams did a wonderful expose, so did David Bradish at the Nuclear Energy Institute, of all of the confabulations of Amory Lovins. And he just keeps making stuff up, and people keep buying it because they think he's a because he has a bachelor's degree in physics.
No,
he doesn't really.
Amory Lovins has no degree in any subject at all.
That's right. He didn't finish anything.
Right. University of Life. qualified in being a good guy. That's what it seems to be to me, that people are just given the position of good guy, and then they can say anything they like. That's odd to me. So I'm hoping, I'm optimistic, particularly in Australia, with a conference that's being held next year, two full days exclusively discussing the role of nuclear power in Australia from the Academy of Technological Sciences and Engineering, a very well-respected body. I'm hoping we're going to move more into a situation where people are going to be called to account a little more to actually make accurate statements. It's interesting because I'll be on a panel talking about how to earn social acceptance of nuclear power in Australia, which I think is an important point. But Rod, one of the co-panelists on that subject is Ian Lowe, who I debated in Sydney in June, and you would have watched his performance. Some of you also may have done so. And I'm thinking back to your remarks about Gregory Jagso and his position regarding nuclear power versus his actual position in the Regulatory Commission. And it seems to me something similar. I'm not quite sure what Ian has to offer there. I would have thought that a good place to start would be some honest factual discussions about nuclear power. It's going to be an interesting talk.
Well, good luck to you.
Yeah, thanks.
All right. Everybody, thank you so much. I hope you all have a very happy New Year. And, of course, Ben, you can give us the head start since it's already New Year's Eve where you are.
Yeah, so far so good, everyone. Going pretty well. I think New Year's Eve should be just absolutely fine. So nothing to worry about. That was the thing, you know, when the world was supposed to end the other day, you know, it was already tomorrow down here. So you really had nothing to worry about.
Yeah, sometimes I think it's already next Tuesday down there, but anyway.
Well, thank you very much, Rod, for asking me.
And I will, and I guess I will circle back finally to I promised Ben we would explain the reference to baked goods before the had. One of Meredith's theories is that the nuclear advocates have a deficit in baked goods. We don't get together enough to break bread and to share fellowship and to make it fun to be associated with people who really are trying to make the world a better place. That's one of the things that we have a disadvantage compared to those who have been, you know, making a social activity out of fighting nuclear energy for so many years. So,
I think that's very important. Baked goods don't travel all that well, but if anyone travels to Australia, do get in touch so I can throw some hospitality on. I'd love that.
I'll keep that in mind.
I'll keep that in mind, too.
Please do. Please do.
All right. Thank you all, and Happy New Year.
Thank
you, Rod. Happy New Year to all.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
There's a way, such a better way. Today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way. Such a better way. Today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. The way is the Adam's way.